You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. On yesterday's Stateside, we heard about a young Flint man named Justin Dawson. His grandmother is Toni Dawson.
He's 28 years old, but I would say mentally probably about 7-8 years old. He's always been a good boy. He did graduate from special ed classes, just way behind mentally.
After his little niece told her therapist that her uncle had touched her inappropriately, Justin Dawson was arrested, and he spent nearly a year in jail before the state ruled him incompetent to stand trial.
He just kept saying every time we'd see him, "Have you talked to my attorney? I want to go home. I don't want to be here anymore. I want to go home." And then he would tell us about other guys in there that would punch him, hit him, or knock him down.
The family says the Genesee County Prosecutor's Office refused their pleas to drop the charges.
And she said, "Well, if you want to drop them, that's fine. Now the state will take over." It was just right from the beginning they were going to bury him. He didn't have a chance. And we kept telling them and telling them, "He doesn't deserve this. Okay, maybe some mental therapy." And they would not listen. They did not care about anything we said.
Even though his family wants him back at home, Justin was sent to Kalamazoo Psychiatric Hospital. The family can't afford to make the trip from Flint to visit him. Let's talk about what Justin's case can teach us about the way our courts handle defendants who are mentally ill or developmentally disabled, and what the courts need to do to meet the mental health crisis. Judge Milton Mack Jr. served as Chief Judge of Wayne County Probate Court. He is now the State Court Administrator, and he has won national recognition for his work on issues related to mental illness. It's a pleasure to welcome you back to Stateside, Judge Mack.
Oh, thank you. Nice to see you again.
So I think of all the times that we've sat across from each other on this program, your never-ending campaign to challenge courts and the criminal justice system to just do better in dealing with people who are mentally ill, who are developmentally disabled. How do you think this system failed, Justin?
The way the system failed, Justin, is the way the system is failing people across America. His case is not unique. A young man in Virginia, for example, he was arrested for stealing $5.05 worth of candy from a 7-Eleven. He thought he was in a relative store. He was arrested, jailed because he couldn't make bail. Eventually, they performed a competency exam, determined he was not competent to stand trial, and ordered him placed in a state psychiatric hospital. He waited in jail for 4 months, slowly starving himself to death and dying of a heart attack. He was 26 years old. His story is not unique.
When I think that, as we heard from his former attorney, that the prosecutor offers him a plea deal that could have gotten him out in home months ago, but he can't take the plea deal because he's developmentally disabled and therefore not mentally competent to stand trial and cannot make a plea deal. What a legal hamster wheel.
It's worse than that, because if he pleads guilty, he may be pleading guilty to an offense that will put him on the sex offender registry.
Yes, that was mentioned.
And that's not a good outcome. We should save our jail space for actual criminals instead of people with mental illness. We warehouse far too many people in our prisons and jails because they're mentally ill. And that's something we got away from back in 1850, but we're back to the future now.
So the way the law stands in Michigan today, when someone who is mentally ill, developmentally disabled, commits a crime, what's the procedure to determine whether he or she belongs in jail or prison?
Well, at this time, there is not much of a procedure at the beginning, at the front end. The person is typically arrested, taken to jail, eventually charged, and then has an attorney, and then they request a psychiatric examination to determine competency. And for a person who is intellectually disabled, the odds are that they're going to be found incompetent to stand trial. And then they'll wait in jail for a space at the forensic center. But there are no spaces at the forensic center.
As we saw with Justin.
Exactly. And the civil beds, which we now call the state psychiatric beds, are now called civil beds. They're half full with patients from the forensic center because there's not room in the forensic center for all the people coming through. So we have to operate the system in a much better way. And we need to start by making sure that people like Justin don't end up in jail in the first place.
At the very beginning of this whole process.
At the very beginning. At the point of arrest.
How long should all of this take? Because in Justin's case, he had to spend a year in jail before he was deemed incompetent and unable to stand trial. And that puts him at great risk. I mean, what you just described to us out of Virginia is a perfect example. Fellow inmates, untrained guards who aren't experienced in handling these complex issues, harming himself.
Well, as I understand, in Justin's case, his intellectual level was around second grade.
6 or 7 years old,
right.
Yeah.
So would you put a 6 or 7 year old child in with a bunch of inmates? I don't think so.
Yet the family insists we did not want him prosecuted, and the prosecutor said, I don't care, we're prosecuting.
What should have happened in a case like that is Justin should have been diverted at the beginning, and he should have gone into assisted outpatient treatment. That would have been the proper thing to do. He should not have spent time in jail. And if the prosecutor wanted to pursue criminal charges, then go ahead and have the examination at the forensic center. But in the meantime, Justin should not be in jail and should not have been in jail. He was not a danger to himself or society. There was no reason to put him in jail. So if you do that, then perhaps Justin can get the treatment he needs to stay well and stay out of trouble.
Which is all, it was very clear, all his sister said to us, and his sister is the mother of the youngster who was inappropriately touched, but she said, we wanted him to get treatment, we wanted him to get help. He wasn't getting any through the family, through a lot of circumstances. All they wanted was to see him get help.
Right. Well, this is the failure of the mental health code. The mental health laws in Michigan, I've said before, they are inpatient models in an outpatient world. Most mental health treatment in America today is delivered on an outpatient basis, but we have mental health codes that focus on preventing hospitalization. Getting a hospital bill is tough. So the idea of having a law which is designed to prevent hospitalization sounds rather peculiar.
Now, this isn't a problem exclusive to Michigan, is it? Because your research has found and over 383,000 people with serious mental illnesses are residing in our nation's jails and prisons, and what, fewer than 40,000 people with mental illnesses are being treated in state-funded hospitals. Boy, that's a big imbalance. So as we talk about policy that could change that, and you say it has to begin at the very beginning, what would that look like?
Well, you would start with doing something that Texas has done. And Texas passed a law this year which requires that all law enforcement personnel be trained in crisis intervention training. Now, Oakland County has done that, and the result has been a huge spike in referrals to mental health treatment instead of jail. In the 5 years before the law, before Oakland County began this, they sent about 50 people to treatment instead of jail. Since that time, they're sending 300 people per year to treatment instead of jail.
That's a big change.
That's a huge change. But more than that, we really have to look at the very front end. And the very front end is, when do we address mental illness for someone who has become incapacitated by mental illness? That means changing the standard for ordering treatment. So what I've advocated for a long time is that when someone becomes incapacitated by their mental illness, we should be able to order assisted outpatient treatment at that time and not wait for crisis. Back in 2004, I served on the Mental Health Commission, and we said the problem with the system is it only intervenes with crisis. We should not wait for arrest. We should not wait for jail. We should intervene and help people stay well before this happens.
In Justin's case, he finally did get to one of these civil beds in a psychiatric hospital, but his family is frustrated. Many circumstances keep them from being able to see him. He's far away from them. His sister said that she can't get any information. They just want to have him closer, maybe an AFC home, group home. Is a psychiatric hospital the best answer for people with mental illness or developmental disability caught up in the criminal justice system?
I would say no. These aren't people who are criminals. These are people who have either intellectual disability or mental illness. And these are people that can be helped outside of jail or prison. Jails and prisons are not therapeutic environments. The truth is that people with mental illness who spend time in jail or prison have a higher rate of recidivism than anyone else. And the sad fact is, data shows that anywhere from 25 to 40% of persons with serious mental illness in America have spent time in jail or prison. That's a shocking statistic. And I don't know how policymakers can allow that to continue.
Well, and when you think of the dollars and cents of it, I'll pull out one more statistic from this policy paper, and I'm reading this, that those with the most severe mental illnesses are annually costing over $95,000 per inmate to house and treat. Average cost for other inmates is $35,000. And in Michigan, we're spending just about $5,700 a year on unincarcerated adults with mental illness. So the dollars and cents don't add up.
Right. Well, if we looked at our jail cells and prison cells as assets, we might feel differently about locking up people with mental illness. My frustration with the mental health system has been that as a judge, I felt like my role was to keep the revolving door spinning. And that's a very unsatisfactory way to go to work in the morning. So I just think if we intervene early, take care of people when we can. The truth is we are now living in what's called the recovery era. And the recovery era suggests that people with mental illness can lead productive, satisfying lives if they are getting their treatment. But the key to that treatment is early intervention and not waiting until they get in very bad shape. The longer you wait, the more difficult it is to recover. The more times you allow a severe psychotic episode to occur, the less likely the person is going to recover. So we risk permanent incapacity and permanent disability by failing to act timely. You know, if we saw someone in distress in a lake and we had a life preserver, we wouldn't wait until they went down for the third time before we threw in the life preserver.
You'd jump in immediately.
Exactly.
Judge Mack, what can you do as state court administrator that perhaps you could not do while you were on the bench at the Wayne County Probate Court? What does this position do for you?
Actually, it enabled me to work closely with the legislature last year to pass major mental health legislation, which allows for assisted outpatient treatment in all mental health cases now. And that was huge. It also allowed a slight modification in the standard for ordering intervention. The old rule said that you had to have someone who was incapacitated and whose behavior would result in significant physical harm. The new standard is that they be incapacitated and that create a substantial risk of significant mental health harm.
It's subtle but important.
It's subtle but important, and it does open the door a little bit. Now, it's not where it should be. Where it should be is we should look at mental illness the way we treat any other illness. For any other illness, if a person is incapacitated, someone can be given the permission to consent to treatment for them. So, for example, in Michigan, I can appoint a guardian for someone who has a mental illness because they're incapacitated, but the guardian can't consent to mental health treatment, even if that would restore their capacity to make informed decisions and terminate the guardianship. Now, the guardian can consent to end-of-life decisions and amputation, but can't consent to mental health treatment that would restore the person's capacity and end the crisis.
Wow.
That's simply absurd.
So as you use this position in Lansing and working close to the legislature, what are some of the big policy changes being debated, things that you think could help Justin Lee Dawson and his family and others like them caught up now?
Well, we'll be proposing legislation to the legislature. And among those things, we're going to suggest that the petitioning process be the same for persons with developmental disabilities as it is for persons with mental illness. And that while the process be the same, the standard can be different for persons with developmental disability, but that there be the opportunity for diversion up front, there be the opportunity for assisted outpatient treatment orders, and that will help in the early stages. But what Michigan really needs beyond that is to change the standard for intervention. That's critical. You have to do that. And then we need to look at screening and diversion. That needs to be done, and we could look at Texas for legislation to support that. We need to require more crisis intervention training across the state. We need to expand our mental health courts across the state. We need to give guardians the authority to consent to mental health treatment. And we need to provide constitutionally adequate mental health services in our jails and prisons. And we have to transition people from jail and prison into the mental health system if they're suffering from mental illness. So there's still a lot of work to be done.
What's the temperature in the legislature for doing this?
Actually, it's pretty high. The Speaker of the House, Representative Leonard, was the sponsor of the major changes in Kevin's Law last year. And I've met with his staff this year to develop more legislation. And I'm working with his staff now in the drafting process. In addition, Representative Clint Kesto, who's chair of House Law and Justice, he's committed to moving forward. And, of course, the lieutenant governor has been a major advocate in this. And between the lieutenant governor and Representative Leonard, last year we saw this major change in mental health law. So I think that the temperature is there. And I think people in Lansing see the need and see the damage that's done by failing to act.
And thinking, as I can do very easily, that this is something that touches so many families. You don't have to go far to have someone say, in my family we have, and I'm one of them. I have a brother who is developmentally disabled and in an adult foster care home. Everyone knows someone, it seems. So I think that there can certainly be interest in the part of the public in seeing this addressed.
Right. I think that's true. You know, before the 1960s, we had a public mental health system, and it was imperfect, no question about it, but it did provide access to mental health services for whoever needed it. And now the system has turned into more of a Medicaid model, and so we have to wait till someone becomes impoverished by their mental illness before that will help them. And I think that's a mistake. The mission of our mental health system should not be to provide you with help once you become poverty-stricken or incarcerated. It should be to keep you away from that sort of thing.
Again, right back to the beginning.
Right.
Judge Milton Mack, State Court Administrator, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
A couple additional notes. According to a billing statement the Dawson family received from the Kalamazoo Psychiatric Hospital and shared with Stateside, during a one-year period from May 1st, 2016 to April 30th of this year, the cost to taxpayers for Justin Lee Dawson's care totaled $318,966.57. We reached out to the Genesee County Prosecutor's Office about Justin's case, and they emailed us this statement, and I quote, "This matter was first brought to our office through a warrant request from the police with allegations of criminal sexual conduct against a young child. We take these cases very seriously. As the situation unfolded and the defendant's mental capacity became apparent, we followed the statutes precisely as they pertain to the adjudication of criminal cases involving developmentally disabled individuals. We joined in the defense motion to the court for a competency evaluation. We told the victim's guardian that our long-term goal was for the defendant to become psychologically stabilized and disengaged from criminal behavior for the protection of the victim and the community. We recommended dismissal of the charges in the best interest of justice so long as the defendant obtained mental health treatment. We certainly hope the defendant is now receiving the treatment he needs. Thanks for listening. I'm Cynthia Canty."